Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
A team of psychologists took about 100 students and divided them into various groups and had some of them listening to an audio book before bedtime. 30 of them were listening to classical music, relaxing classical music, I must say, because it's, you know, you need it relaxing if you're trying to go to sleep. And another 30 of them weren't doing anything. They were just having their stressful time and trying to get to sleep. But they found within 3 weeks, 90% of the young people involved became good sleepers just by listening to 45 minutes of classical music as they were going to bed or as they were, you know, tucked up in bed. So you can make yourself a playlist. If you've got anybody else in your friend group or family who's having trouble sleeping, make a playlist of relaxing classical music. You can buy these things as well. And play about 40 minutes as you go to bed. And within 3 weeks, you'll start sleeping better with a much better rhythm. And that will make your stress levels drop, and therefore your depression level will also drop. And this really does happen. So it's really worth trying it. Because what's happening is you can measure these chemicals in your bloodstream, and the relaxing classical music, or relaxing music of any sort, really. The classical music is rather reliable because it doesn't have any bumps in it. But relaxing music lowers the level of noradrenaline in your bloodstream, and that will make you drop off to sleep easier and stay asleep for longer.
If I were not a physicist, I would probably be a musician. I often think in music. I live my daydreams in music. I see my life in terms of music. The words of theoretical physicist, writer and philosopher of science Albert Einstein. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. What does your taste in music say about your personality? Is there a link between music and intelligence? And can our bedtime listening lower stress levels, improve libido, and reduce pain? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to tackle those questions with musicologist, physicist, and author Dr. John Powell, whose new book, Why We Love Music, has just been published by John Murray, where John writes, "When we hear a piece of music, we use a large mental library of music we have already heard to give us some context, and we unconsciously construct a new set of expectations. We predict that the tune will rise and fall, get louder or softer, and we are often right." John goes on to argue, "It is much easier to distance yourself from a visual image than from a sound." So what's in a tune, and how does music push our emotional buttons?
My name's John Powell. I am a musician, but I'm also a scientist, which is a very peculiar combination of interests. And a few years ago, I wrote a book called How Music Works, which explains the science behind music, because there's lots of science, engineering, ergonomics, and all sorts of other things behind actual the beauty of music. For example, we need to know where the holes in a flute go, otherwise you get the wrong notes. And the general reader doesn't really know anything about all this. And I read several books on it, and I thought it was fascinating, but the books are very complicated and written in a very dry style. So I wrote the whole thing up in chatty English, and wrote this book called How Music Works, and people liked it. In the book, I put my email, and people wrote to my email address and said, "Well, this science stuff is all very nice, but we'd like to know a bit more about the psychology of music." So I spent another 4 years reading all the psychology textbooks I can find, and they were much the same. They were written in a very dry style, but the content was really fascinating. So once again, I spent many years reading all about this stuff and then rewriting it into chatty English so that the general reader can hear all this stuff. Because the actual results of all these psychological experiments is really fascinating. Things like how music makes you spend more in restaurants and so on. And I thought it'd be interesting to put it all into just conversational English with a few jokes thrown in.
Really well done on the book, John. I have to say I really enjoyed it. And I love when you say about chatty English. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off. And shall we see where we go with that? Do you think you can understand or at least get to know somebody through their taste in music?
Yes, it does. And this isn't just mumbo jumbo. It's actually been analysed by teams of psychologists. By the 1990s, psychologists had decided that there were actually 5 basic personality traits that can be reliably measured. Openness, which is also referred to as culture or intellect, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, or emotional instability. And they've also added a 6th one recently, which is a combination of honesty and humility. So with these 5 or 6 measures, if you give yourself, or if somebody else gives you marks out of 10 out of the 5 different aspects of your personality, you can describe someone's personality repeatedly and quite accurately. So the music psychologists have bonded various personality traits to various types of music. Before they could do that, they had to divide music into five basic genres, which they came up with reflective and complex, which is stuff like classical, jazz, folk, and blues, intense and rebellious music, which is rock, alternative, and heavy metal, upbeat and conventional is, as you'd imagine, pop soundtracks and country music, and energetic and rhythmic music, which is rap, soul, and electronic. So certain personalities prefer certain sorts of music. People who like reflective and complex music tend to score high on openness, which is the culture or intellect thing. They're generally poor at sports, they're good with words, and often politically liberal. So you can go through all the various genres like this, and it's all very interesting. One very interesting thing about it is if you give a psychologist or even a friend a list of your 10 favorite tracks, they can work out how old you are, because about four or five of them, a very high percentage of them, would have come from the ages when they were between 17 and 23, because that's an age range in which we're sort of solidifying our personalities. And part of that process is deciding what music we like. And we tend to fall in love with lots of music in our mid to late teens and our early 20s. And I'm sure that people out there who are in their 50s and 60s all have a great deal of love for music they heard when they're about that age.
So what does that scale say, or what does your music taste say about, let's say, your appetite or political consciousness or drive, you know, all that type of stuff?
It depends, because you can have requirements for different levels of drive when you're in different moods, can't you? So we all have a fairly wide range of music we like, and we all, you know, let's say you like country and western primarily, then there'll be active and jolly country and western music that you'll listen to when you're working or gardening or something, and other stuff that you'll listen to in the evening when you're trying to relax. So within each genre of music, there's a range of activities, if you like, or activity level, which you can use to concentrate your mind. But in fact, you have to be careful, because music in general takes up some of your mental processing time. And if you want to work best, if you're doing anything intellectual, like trying to study for a test or writing something, then it's best to work in silence. Because music, if you think about your brain as being like a computer, then music playing in the background is using up some of your computing power and making your brain work not so well. It only improves your performance if the alternative is something very noisy and distracting. So if you're a student working in a canteen, trying to get this essay finished before you have to hand it in 10 minutes, which is the sort of thing I used to do, then music on headphones will actually cut out all the distracting noises and help you work. But if you're at home, trying to revise for something, or studying for your theory test on driving, or whatever else it happens to be, then you always do your best work when you're working in silence, because your brain's not distracted. And the most distracting music is the stuff with lyrics. So I'm afraid, students, if you're listening to this, that you have to turn off the songs, and it'll help you study harder and faster.
Why do you think it is, John, that some people get unbelievably judgmental about music taste? Like, you could be at some social function or on a date or whatever it is, and you start talking about music and then things suddenly collapse.
Yeah, well, there's a word which is very often misused here, but we can use it quite easily here, and that's cool. Now, everybody wants to be cool, but cool means different things to different people. Cool really just means acceptance by your peer group. And of course, if you're out on a date, you want to be accepted by that particular member of your peer group. And if you share the same things and other people don't share them, it's important that if you're going to be cool, you and your friends have to share something which you consider to be cool, which isn't shared generally in the population. So if I'm on a date and I suddenly say to somebody that I love the work of Leonard Cohen, say, and they do too, then we've formed an exclusive group, just me and her. Obviously, there are other fans of Leonard Cohen, but they don't happen to be in the restaurant at the time. And so that bonds you together with people. So you do feel attractive to people who have the same taste in whatever it might be. It might be blue scarves or a certain novelist or a certain food. But certainly music is one of those things that does bond people together, because you have a sort of joint background. And it's also, it means that if you consider yourself cool, which most people do, then the other person is showing how cool they are by joining you.
It's funny how you could be midway in conversation, though, and with somebody that you find unbelievably attractive, and suddenly they drop something about music, and it's a killer, isn't it?
Yeah, Yes, the Barry Manilow effect. Yeah, the thing to do if you're out with somebody you fancy, and the date's going okay, if they introduce some music you're not sure about, then you should start listening to it, because you might want to show how cool you are in the future. So, you know, and the thing is that all music is lovable. You can love it all. Sibelius is no better than the Beatles, which is no better than Eminem, which is no better than Taylor Swift. They're all things that individuals love, and if they love them, you can love them too, if you approach it in the right way. And it's very simple. All you have to do is get a CD in your car or a playlist, which is stuff that you're not actually used to. Let's say Bhangra, for example, sort of European Indian type music with a high sort of disco drive to it. Then if you start playing a Bhangra playlist or CD in your car for day after day, you'll start getting used to the whole genre. You'll be able to forecast what's happening next, as most of us can in a pop song, for example. We can always tell when a pop song is going to end. We can tell when the chorus is going to start. We know that there are millions of things that could happen which don't in a pop song. So we're used to the sort of landscape of a pop song. And that's one of the reasons we enjoy them, because we can forecast what's going to happen generally. Now, with an unfamiliar sort of music, you can't forecast what's going to happen. And that's why you feel uncomfortable with it. Yeah. But once you've listened to it for a few hours, these forecasts start working properly, and you start being less surprised by what's going on, and then you start enjoying it, and then you can eventually fall in love with it. Yeah. And you can increase your pleasure in life simply by listening to a new form of music for just on certain occasions, you know, when you're in the car, for example, as I said. If you do this for a couple of weeks, then you have a new genre of music to enjoy, and it doesn't take away from the old genre, so all you're doing is doubling your pleasure.
Do you think you could do that with death metal?
Yes, I think you could do it with anything. I haven't done it with heavy metal was pretty good when I was very much younger. But the music that I loved when I was about 20 is something which is very unfashionable nowadays. It's called prog rock. And it's just a genre which I loved. If I meet people who love it too, then we bond faster than we would do otherwise.
Schoenberg described music as frozen architecture. Do you think he's got a point in that? It's a very interesting way to look at music, isn't it?
Yeah, there's lots of metaphors you can use for music, but really, none of them actually explains it at all properly. I've got a bit of a bone to pick with Schoenberg anyway, because he has some peculiarly daft ideas about how people should enjoy music. He thought it was an intellectual process, and that you could do it basically with a mathematical approach, which I don't think is right. Schoenberg, in his own compositions, had laid down rules about what he should be doing, which had nothing to do with the sound that was coming out of the instruments. So if you read the book, you'll see that I make a strong case that Schoenberg was working against people's emotional capacity. You know, you can't warm to it very easily if you can't remember any tunes or any harmonies.
You write, our musical preferences are not created in a vacuum. Can you talk me through that?
No, they're not. I mean, basically, as I said earlier, we have to get used to the grammar of what's going on in any piece of music, and most of your listeners will be very familiar with Western pop music. So you don't form your likes and dislikes in a vacuum, in the same way as you don't with food. Mm. Anything that's unfamiliar is slightly threatening. And there's a very good reason for this, because, you know, back in the caveman days, if you had something unfamiliar, it was probably going to be dangerous. So you didn't eat the unusual berries you had seen until somebody else had, to see whether they got poisoned. So there's no such thing as developing tastes or pleasure systems in a vacuum. Basically, you do it in the context of what your friends and peer group do.
Did you read Diana Deutsch's The Psychology of Music, did you?
Yes, all 700 pages of it.
What did you make of it?
It was brilliant. I mean, basically, Diana Deutsch didn't write it. She wrote a few chapters. She was the editor of it, and she got all the world's experts in music psychology to write a chapter or two each. And the result is very, very interesting, but it basically formed the basics for my book, because that book is written in academic language. Mm. They use lots of jargon. They never say anything enthusiastically, because that's not what a professional psychologist is supposed to do. And so it's very difficult to get to the point of what they're saying, because they might spend a cautious 4,000 words saying that, for example, people tend to spend more in restaurants if there's classical music playing. So what I would do is read a chapter or two of that. I think, that's the point of this. And then I just write down the basic point, and I can take the risk of saying it and it being disproved in 15 years, because I'm not a professional psychologist working in that field. I'm basically picking up all the information they've written and regurgitating it in a much more sort of digestible form.
I loved your research on lyrics and music and how different types of people respond to different types of lyrics and how they engage with it all. It's also interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, lyrics is a whole subject on its own really, because you've got poetry involved there. But you don't really need a lot of content or poetry for people to get emotionally engaged with lyrics. You can just have a singer singing baby, baby, baby over and over, and that's plenty. That's for people to get emotionally involved. And there are a wide range of lyrics from the incomprehensible. But if I go back to my prog rock days, one of my favourite bands was a band called Yes, who were very famous back in the 70s. But most of their lyrics were just rubbish. I mean, they were just noises. But I liked it, and because it had music to it, it had some sort of emotional content, even though it didn't make any sense. Then you look at Leonard Cohen, for example, who is very poetic and very beautiful, although some of that is also incomprehensible. And obviously you're getting the emotional content then from the genuine meaning of the words, as well as the fact they're set to music. Human voices, you can feel the stress or emotional in a human voice just by the way it's used. For example, one of the things I found out when I was writing the book is that rock singers, when they're singing really loud, aren't singing any louder than when they're singing normally. They just put more stress in their voice, and it sounds louder. Because if you have a stressed voice, people pay more attention to it, because it's an urgent animal response. If someone around you is making a stressed noise, you need to pay attention. So rock singers don't actually sing with any more volume, they just sing with more stress, and that makes us pay more attention, and that makes the music sound louder.
But it is interesting to see how some listeners engage with music lyrics. Like when you take, for example, the big fallout over Bob Dylan getting the Nobel Prize for Literature, a lot of people were very put out by that and said, well, he's just a musician. They could not see how his music could be seen as poetry, that music can transcend into literature. That it's just, they just see music as just music and that's it. Do you think there's a lot of snobbery in the music business? Is that what the problem is?
There's a lot of snobbery throughout music, actually. And everybody, well, not everybody, most people have their own sort of corner that they fight and defend, and classical music buffs will say, oh no, classical music is the only real music. But on the other hand, Indian classical music lovers will be saying that Indian classical music, ragas and so on, are the only real music. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you just open your ears a bit wider and listen to the other stuff and get used to it, as I said earlier, and let it sink in so you get the grammar in your head so you can understand what's being said, then you can love any of it, and there is no real hierarchy. There's a little bit of a hierarchy between music which takes a lot of effort to perform and compose, as opposed to a sort of 12-bar blues, some of which are very beautiful, but they don't take so much preparation in getting them ready. But that's not a hierarchy in quality.
But ultimately, it's about impact and the impact a piece of music has on your body, mind and soul. And the music could be very very heavily orchestrated and very complex, or it could be very simply put together. But it's about how you feel when you listen to the music and its impact on you, isn't it?
Yeah, this thing about complexity is quite interesting. We have a sort of Goldilocks attitude to complexity, which is why, I don't know whether your listeners have had this experience, but I certainly have, a single comes on the radio and you absolutely love it and you want to hear, you can't hear enough of it, and you hear it solidly on the radio for about 4 or 5 days, and then suddenly, after about the 20th listening, you think, this is a bit dull, I've had enough of it now, and you go right off it. And then sometimes, a year later, you can't stand listening to it. And this is largely to do with our attitude to complexity in music, because we don't like music to be too boring, and we don't like it to be too complicated. And of course, too boring means something different to a 5-year-old than it does to a 50-year-old. And too complicated also is completely different. And also, people, professional musicians, will find things which are too complicated for some people quite pleasurable. So where you're too boring and too complicated are varies from person to person. But whenever you hear a piece of music for the first time, it's actually slightly more complicated than it actually is, because it's the first time you've heard it. And you don't know what's going to happen next. And you can't forecast exactly where the chord changes are going to be. You needn't know anything about chord changes or be a musician for this. Everybody does it. Basically, you can't la-la along with it the first time you hear it, because you don't know what's happening next. And so it has an extra layer of complexity. So then, at that point, it might fall between your too boring and too complicated thing immediately, and you fall in love with it. Mm-hmm. But as you get used to it and you hear it over and over again, you start realizing what's going to happen next. And sometimes the piece of music falls below your too boring threshold. Mm-hmm. And you can't stand it anymore.
But it is amazing the emotional and physiological impact of music. Some music you can listen to can really raise your heartbeat. Others can bring tears to your eyes. Others you just can make you want to sweat. So it is remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredible. Most people will be familiar with that sort of thing, but they won't be familiar with the fact that music can change what you buy in shops, which is very, very odd. I'll just give you an example of this, because a couple of psychologists took over the end-of-aisle display in the wine department of a supermarket. They did this a couple of times, a few years apart in different countries, and it always worked perfectly. And what happens is really weird. So you take over the end-of-aisle display in a wine shop or in a supermarket, and you divide four shelves into French and German wine. So you have French on the left, German on the right, and you match the wine for price. You might have some that are more expensive and some that are cheaper, but you have one French and one German for each one. And you match them for taste as well. And you just leave them there, and they're the same sort of price on each shelf. Then you put a single speaker on top of the shelves and play music through it, or not. And then all you have to do is change the music and watch what happens at the tills. So they did this, and they found that if they didn't play any music at all, more French than German wine was sold, which is perfectly reasonable and perfectly normal in most of Europe. That's what would happen. Then they started playing German sort of Bavarian umpire music very quietly through this speaker. And then they watched what happened at the tills, and they sold twice as much German as French wine while they had that music playing, which is pretty incredible. Then they stopped the German music and played French Parisian cafe music through that speaker very quietly. And at that point, they started selling five times more French than German, which is incredible. So there's an order of magnitude difference between German and French. You've got twice as much German being sold with the German music, and five times as much French being sold with the French music. But the really peculiar thing is that the psychologists then stood outside the shop and asked the shoppers as they came out with their wine how they felt about the music that they heard when they were buying the wine. And that nearly all of them, about 90% of them, said, "What music?" They hadn't even noticed music was playing, but the music had infiltrated their mind and changed what country wine they bought.
Thank you.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with British musicologist, teacher and author Dr. John Powell on his new book, Why We Love Music. I asked John about musical preferences and why some people are completely anti-reggae or completely anti-the blues or completely anti-jazz and will only listen to, let's say, rock or traditional music. And it's a case of get stuff to the rest. I asked John, how does he explain it all?
I can give you some pointers towards what the truth might be. Some of it will be the fact that a group of people they didn't consider cool when they were in their teens and 20s listen to that music, and so they will sort of relegate those people and anything they do to sort of a subgroup. And if they had a bunch of people at school who just liked reggae and they weren't their friends, that can sort of contaminate their feeling for reggae. But you know, what they should do is come back to it later and listen to it properly. Nobody's got too much music in their life, so you should always be open to a new genre, because some of them are just incredible. There are some things, you know, which are very difficult to get on with, but most music is extremely lovable.
Can we talk about music as a medicine? You've got some great stuff about how music can support people who are experiencing depression or anxiety or other types of mood problems. And I know there's lots of research to say singing in choirs can really be good for your mental health. But can you talk me through it all?
Yeah. There are some very pleasing results here, and some things which could be useful to your listeners immediately if they have trouble sleeping, for example, because they've done tests on this. I mean, it's all very well to say music helps you sleep, but it's not just mumbo jumbo. This is actually stuff which psychologists and medical teams have worked on, and they've proved it categorically. So if you have trouble sleeping, what's happening is you have too much of a drug in your system called noradrenaline. It's the drug that keeps you vigilant. It's a self-made drug. We make drugs for ourselves all the time. Adrenaline, if we're in trouble, to give us lots of energy. Cortisol, to help us have more energy, but then also to ignore any damage that happens to us during a difficult fight or whatever. But this stuff, noradrenaline, is to keep you vigilant, to stop you getting eaten by lions or whatever it is. And we still have it in these modern days. And the trouble is that if your boss shouts at you while you're at work, then you get an adrenaline shot, just as if a lion was attacking you, you know, 500,000 years ago. So we still have these systems which kick in. And if you are getting lots of adrenaline, lots of cortisol, and lots of noradrenaline into your blood system all the time, then you end up being stressed because you're not burning off the energy by running away. You're sitting at your desk trying to ignore the fact your boss has just shouted at you. And so stress is often linked to depression and also not sleeping very well. And if you don't sleep very well, then you get more stressed and more depressed. It's a cycle that needs to be broken. And it can be broken by music. A team of psychologists took about 100 students and divided them into various groups and had some of them listening to an audio book before bedtime. 30 of them were listening to classical music, relaxing classical music, I must say, because it's you need it relaxing if you're trying to go to sleep. And another 30 of them weren't doing anything. They were just having their stressful time trying to get to sleep. But they found within 3 weeks, 90% of the young people involved became good sleepers just by listening to 45 minutes of classical music as they were going to bed or as they were tucked up in bed. So you can make yourself a playlist. Or if you've got anybody else in your friend group or family who's having trouble sleeping, make a playlist of relaxing classical music. You can buy these things as well. And play about 40 minutes as you go to bed. And within 3 weeks, you'll start sleeping better with a much better rhythm. And that will make your stress levels drop. And therefore, your depression level will also drop. And this really does happen. So it's really worth trying it. Because what's happening is you can measure these chemicals in your bloodstream, and the relaxing classical music, or relaxing music of any sort, really. The classical music is rather reliable because it doesn't have any bumps in it. But relaxing music lowers the level of noradrenaline in your bloodstream, and that will make you drop off to sleep easier and stay asleep for longer.
What about pain management and mojo? What does the research say about that?
Yeah, pain management's very interesting as well. You can actually manage pain with music, and this has also been measured. Now, the thing about pain is it's not a thing, it's just a perception. You can't measure pain because it's not the same. You could have the same painful experience on two different occasions, and you wouldn't feel the same pain in each case. For example, if I stub my foot on a quiet Sunday morning when I'm going to get the papers or something, then it might hurt a lot. I'll do a lot of swearing about it. But if I stub my toe exactly the same amount when I'm running to catch a child before it runs into traffic, then I won't notice it at all. And I might never notice the fact that I've hurt my foot because I was so busy doing something else. So pain isn't actually a thing. It's just a perception. And because perceptions are held in the brain, and music is processed by the brain, you can actually use music to diminish pain. They've found this with dental pain particularly, because it's a nice one to measure. And what has happened is that they found that people experience less pain if they get to choose the music that's playing in the background at the dentist. And one very nice result was that if you give the patient the volume control of the music and tell them that they can control the volume of the music that's playing, and it will have some effect on the pain they're going to experience, then the patient feels empowered. And there's nothing like empowerment to make you feel less pain. But it's the disorientation and you're not in control which actually delivers a lot of the pain when you're at the dentist. So all they have to do is let you choose the music and give you the volume control, and you'll feel considerably less pain when you're at the dentist.
John, one of the interesting questions that you pitch up is whether by listening to certain types of music or by playing a specific musical instrument, that it can make you more intelligent. Do you agree with all of that? Like, do you think, does the research stand up on all of that?
Well, this is the Mozart effect. And if people have heard of it, then they may have heard of a test that took place in 1993, where psychologists took bunches of people and they had to do an IQ test, which is a particular sort of IQ test, where you look at drawings of how a piece of paper should be folded and then cut, and then you imagine what it would look like when it's been unwrapped. And it's a standard IQ test. You know, usually in a big IQ test, you get four or five of these amongst the 100 questions you get. So this particular researcher got students together and had 10, some of them listening to a Mozart piano piece before they did the test, some of them listened to relaxation instructions, and some of them just sat in silence, and then they did the IQ test. And the ones that listened to the Mozart got 8 or 9 higher IQ points than anybody else, which was, it's a useful, you know, improvement. 10 IQ points is quite good. So Francis Rauker actually published this result, and it became extremely famous very rapidly. And before long, Florida, for example, passed a legal bill saying that daycare centers have got to play classical music. And Texas prisons were playing symphonies all the time, because in the hope that everybody would get brighter and calmer. And of course, I can imagine the arguments in the showers in the prisons, of people arguing about whether Sibelius is better than Led Zeppelin. But anyway, this whole thing became very fashionable in psychological circles. Lots of researchers jumped on the bandwagon to try and find out what the Mozart effect was. And quite quickly, they found out that the Mozart effect does work, but it has nothing at all to do with Mozart. They found exactly the same result if you tried any other classical composer, like Schubert, for example. That worked. Blur worked, the pop band Blur, and even listening to Stephen King's short stories worked. And the whole thing is that if you are slightly stimulated by what you just listened to, and you're also in a good mood, you'll do better in an IQ test. So anything you like, which is slightly stimulating, listen to it for 10 minutes before you do any test, and your brain will be awake and in a good mood, and those two things are actually associated with other chemicals we pump into our own blood systems. Dopamine is the good mood drug, and norepinephrine is the arousal drug, and those two together make you perform better in IQ tests, and music can trigger those two.
One of the more consoling aspects of the book that I really enjoyed was on musical talent. And you really debunked the idea that musical ability is a God-given gift. And you argue that, you know, if you pull in the hard slog and you work at something, well, then you will master, let's say, a musical instrument. So I think you say somewhere that, you know, if you put in about 7,000 hours, that you will be able to master a musical instrument and you'll be quite an accomplished player. It's also interesting because some musicians would take great umbrage to the fact that, you know, it's not this kind of heavenly talent.
Basically, yes. Learning a musical instrument is a real pain in the neck in the early stages because it's all completely unfamiliar and very difficult. And that's where people drop out at that point. And in the UK, we have the grade system. So you get grade 1 after a year or so, then grade 2 after another year or so, and so on. And after about 8 years of fairly hard work, you're grade 8 and you can perform at your sister's wedding or something, because you know, you're quite good at your instrument, and you can actually then go on to music college. And so some researchers, armed with the grade results for several hundred students, they looked into how many hours of work went into each student graduating through the different grades and how long it took them to get there. Now, there were some students who went through the grades very quickly and some went through very slowly and dropped out. And so they divided them into different groups. Now, these ones are the really good musicians. These ones are not that good. Divided into five groups, and they find out that within each of the five groups, the number of hours required to get from one grade to another was the same. Basically, the kids that did an hour a day rocketed through the grades, and the ones that did 10 minutes a day did exactly the same number of hours per grade, but did it more slowly. But of course, the kids that rocketed through the grades appeared to be more talented, but they weren't. They were just doing the work faster. Yeah. Well, they were doing the work in less time, because they were doing more hours a day.
John, do you think we could apply that to other types of, let's say, talents or abilities, like, for example, sport or business? Do you think if you kind of work hard enough at something that you can accomplish it? Or do you think there are some activities in life that, you know, that it is a kind of innate gift? Like, some people could write loads of books and hammer away at the keyboard, but, like, they're all a load of crap.
Yeah, it's very difficult. You need to have proper measures, and in the case of music, they were lucky that they had these things, so they got the grade exams. I suspect that most human endeavour involves just a lot of work. Basically, there's a sort of rule of thumb that if you spend 10,000 hours trying to improve at something, not just doing it, you've got to be trying to improve in every one of those hours, then you become an expert, a real solid expert. So if you do, whether it's karate or landscape gardening or whatever, and music as well, of course. If you have 10,000 hours of actual real practice, and as I say, not just repeating what you did yesterday, but doing something a little more tricky today than you were doing yesterday, then you do become an expert, you know, willy-nilly. It doesn't really matter. It could be interior decorating or writing symphonies.
Can we talk about plagiarism and copyright? One of the really interesting chapters in your book is where you argue that, you know, music is constantly evolving and it's constantly progressing. And I think you write somewhere that good artists borrow and great artists steal. So what's your own view? Because it's a very divided and sharp topic, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's been very trendy in the courts in America of late. And I wish I'd been there to be an expert witness, A, for the pay, and B, for the pleasure of telling them that they've got it all around their neck. Let's use two musical icons here. Iggy Pop. Iggy Pop wrote a song in 1977 called Lust for Life. If you listen to that song, it's very similar to several of the Martha and Vandellas and Supremes tracks from the 60s. You Can't Hurry Love, for example, and I'm Ready for Love. They've got that dum 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 dum, that sort of bass line behind it, and it sounds very similar. But Iggy Pop isn't plagiarizing the early music. He heard it, and he's built on it and created something new. And he wasn't copying it, you know. He just liked it in the first place. He gave it more drive than the one he did, and he basically used it as a launching pad for the piece of music he wrote. And I think the piece of music is excellent. So I wouldn't have wanted Iggy Pop not to bring it out because it sounded too close to something that happened earlier. But the thing is that Mozart copied some stuff off Bach, and Beethoven copied stuff off Mozart, and because they'd heard it, it might even be subconscious. There's a great story about the Stones, the Rolling Stones. Keith Richards and Mick Jagger write songs together, and they've been doing it for years. And Mick Jagger is known to be a sort of musical sponge. He soaks in music wherever he goes. And sometimes, a week or so later, he thinks he's written something that he just heard a week earlier. And this is usually no problem, but on one occasion, it nearly turned into a legal problem, because Keith Richards took the new album home to his family. The album was Bridges to Babylon. And his family was sitting around waiting to listen to it, and then he put the track on. And then the track Anybody Seen My Baby came on. And during the chorus, Keith's daughter Angela started singing different words, to which Keith wasn't very happy, wondering what they were doing. And it turns out that Angela was quite right. The tune was an exact copy of Constant Craving by Katie Lang. And so Keith Richards, being an honest man, checked that out, and sure enough, they'd stolen the tune accidentally. So then they got the lawyers on the phone straight away to Katie Lang and cut her in as part of the deal. And if you look on the album now, you'll see that Katie Lang is actually on there as a co-writer of that song, even though she'd never heard it.
But you could argue, John, that all artists are in collaboration with those alive or dead, and that, you know, it's all in relationship, and that everyone influences everybody else. You know, nobody is an artist in isolation. Anyway, what's your own view of film soundtracks and music and film? Do you think we get too much of it? Like, I think you could argue that in some movies, the actual soundtrack is as important as the storyline, isn't it?
I think emotionally, yeah, the soundtracks of films are as important as the storyline, because if you take away the music in many cases, the storyline becomes a lot less strong emotionally. If you watch any film with the music missing, you'll find lots of information that you were getting has gone missing. For example, music will tell you if the action's ambiguous, if you don't know whether someone's going to have a happy time or a good time in a few minutes, the music will tell you that. And it can also tell you which decade you're in, if it's the correct music for the right decade. And one of the great things that music is good at is providing urgency. Yeah. Because if you've got a ticking bomb somewhere and someone's running to find, you know, the answer to turning it off, just the running around stuff isn't very urgent. You have to keep being reminded that the bomb's ticking. And if you've got driving music pushing that forward and accelerating all the time, getting louder, then it'll drive your adrenaline levels up and make you anxious. And so you'll get much more involved in the urgency part of the film.
Well, I know all about urgency in music. I was at a Pedro Almodóvar movie there, at least 10 years ago. And I was with a colleague from work, and the soundtrack was absolutely unbelievable. It's beautiful Spanish music. And I don't know what happened to me. I totally lost the run of myself and politely put, jumped on top of my mate. And I couldn't explain it afterwards, except that the music, well, it was just so profound. It just had such a transformative effect, you know, that that music can do that to you, that it can just bring on great emotions and it can do all sorts of things. And in my case, it just put me in this state, I suppose, of seduction of some sort.
Yeah, indeed. Excellent. Let's find that film. One really odd thing about music and films is that you feel your emotions much more strongly if you give them the wrong music before an emotional climax. For example, if someone's looking through a wood, you know, they're looking through a forest and you don't know whether they're going to find their daughter or a body, if they play happy music before they find a body, it's incredibly shocking. So you feel the emotional shock of the death of the other person much more strongly because they played happy music while he or she was being looked for. The reverse is also true. If you have got doom-laden music playing while someone's, you know, looking for somebody, and they find them safe and sound, the relief is much, much bigger because the doom-laden music was giving the indication that something was going to go really wrong here. So a lot of film composers, you know, tug on our heartstrings either way by having either driving, you know, anxious music when the whole thing's going to be resolved, or happy music when the anxiety is just around the corner. There's lots of tricks they use.
Yeah, it's so interesting because music pervades every aspect of our life. I know that you argue somewhere that, you know, 2/3 of the activities we do in our daily lives, that they're all done to the background of music. It's, you know, it's everywhere really, isn't it?
Yes, lots of things we do have got background music. Music we haven't chosen. Obviously, there's a lot of time in the day when we choose the music that's playing. You know, in the car or on your headphones or back in your living room. But there's also plenty of time when you're shopping, for example, when music that's playing in the background is altering your mood. Now, they've found that just about any background music tends to uplift your mood, which is a great thing. And this is, you know, something that they use in shops and restaurants. Good background music can increase your sales by about 10%. And particularly in restaurants, it's very peculiar because slow music makes you take fewer bites per minute. And so you spend more time over your food. That means you generally spend more money on drink. So if you're in a sort of traditional restaurant for the over 40s and you want them to stay there and spend lots of money, play slow music. But if you want lots of table turnaround with young people coming and going and you get more people in per evening, then you play faster music, they eat faster, they leave quicker. And one of the worst things you can do, though, is choose the wrong music. And this does happen sometimes in restaurants I go to, because I'm over 50 and I want to go to a quiet restaurant and chat with my friends and drink and eat and do everything slowly. If the staff get control of the music, they're all in their 20s and they're running around having a good time. They put music they want on, which is faster music, which makes me slightly anxious. I start eating faster. But also they turn the volume up because they're enjoying it. So you get a restaurant which is supposed to be calming and slow, speeding up and loud. So the worst thing that a manager can do is let the staff choose the music.
Would you not just complain, though?
I have done many times, yeah. It's always a bit of a shame because the staff are enjoying themselves, and it's a shame for that. But I'm forever asking the music to be turned down. And maybe you've been to this thing where you go to a pub at lunchtime and the music's deafening because they left the volume up from the previous night. That does happen because during the course of the evening, everything gets louder. And then they come back to the stereo at lunchtime the following morning, press go, and it's an evening volume. I do notice music probably more than most people, so I do find it incredibly irritating if I'm being given the wrong music for the mood I'm in.
Last question for you, John. Music to love to and music to die to. What will it be?
Oh, well, this music to die to thing is, it sounds morbid, but it's a conversation I've had with several friends in various bars through the years. And it's interesting to choose the music you'd have at your own funeral, imagining all your friends mourning you're going, but enjoying the music you're playing. So, and you want a track for when you're going in and when you're coming out. I've only chosen one of them so far. It's a track by The Who called Blue, Red and Grey, because the refrain in that song is, I love every minute of the day, which is something I try to do. It's difficult some days, but that's the way it is. And music to love to, well, I think the famous guitar concerto by Rodrigo, I think I would go for. The one that goes, da-da-da, my beautiful singing voice there. But yes, I recommend that for anybody who wants a nice sunny mood.
So you're romantic, are you, John?
On occasion, yes.
British musician, teacher and writer, Dr. John Powell. Why We Love Music, from Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Musical Sounds, is published by John Murray and retails for just under €12 in paperback. Now, I have to say, for anyone interested in the business, politics, history or psychology of music, this is a book for you. It's lively, expansive and incredibly well researched. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to Ronan Pernock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the focus words of Jamaican singer-songwriter and guitarist Bob Marley, who once quipped, My music fights the system that teaches us to live and die. Powerful words indeed. Good night.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi. Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Ooh, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Oh, have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop at the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Yes, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs. All I ever have, redemption songs. These songs of freedom. Songs of freedom.